this week on COVID, race, and democracy.
Robb Elementary School has to be remembered not just for this mass shooting, but for the mass walkout of over 500 students in that school and in that community on April 14th, 1970, organized by a community-based struggle that was part of the broader history of the Chicano movement, locally, regionally, and nationally.
Camilo Perez Bustillo from the Hope Water Institute talks about the history of Robb Elementary School and the struggle against segregation in Uvalde.
So our children, our teachers, people in the school systems are experiencing secondary trauma just by knowing that the shootings happened. If we don't give it voice and talk about it, it doesn't make it go away.
School counselor and educator Bronwyn Lucas.
We're all familiar with the ravenous U.S. foreign policy. That illustrates the point that political disputes should be settled through the barrel of a gun. It also leads to a certain kind of cheapening of life that is returned with velocity to these shores, not to mention the fact that inevitably, I think it's coarsened the psyche of too many in this country, leading predictably to what happened in Uvalde and in Buffalo.
And historian Dr. Gerald Horn. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. On Thursday, President Joe Biden called on Congress to pass sweeping gun control legislation, including banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, during his primetime address to the nation. Biden asked U.S. lawmakers, "How much more carnage are you willing to accept?" He said if assault weapons cannot be banned, the age to purchase an assault weapon should be raised to 21. The president also called for common sense measures such as red flag laws, a repeal of the liability shield for gun manufacturers, and a safe storage law. The history of Robb Elementary School, where the massacre took place in Uvalde, is important to the struggle, identity, and fight against cultural erasure. KPFA Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein spoke to Camilo Perez Bustillo, Director of Research, Advocacy, and Leadership Development at the Hope Water Institute, based in the U.S.-Mexico border region in El Paso, Texas, about the important history of resistance against segregation.
Uvalde is a Mexican border community. That's the first thing. You know, it's generically described in the media, you know, everywhere. If it's described at all in terms of the, you know, the nature of the community, its characteristics, it's just described generically as a, quote, Hispanic or Latino community. That doesn't do it. We're talking about the specific history of Texas itself and where Uvalde and the broader border region fit into that. And we're talking about the history of the Uvalde community and of the school. So we have to connect all of those different fragments, all of those different pieces. The first thing is it's located within the zone where the Border Patrol exerts the most power in terms of daily policing. That's why there was this effort that I think we also have to question and put within a very critical framework to make the Border Patrol the heroes of this particular film.
Right. Right.
And to glorify their role, you know, supposedly they're stepping in to do everything the local police didn't. But what that also serves to do is play up their role in that community and at the border. And all of the terror historically associated with the Border Patrol, which we have to remember emerged in the 1920s in the context of Texas as the successor to the Texas Rangers, right? And then we have to look at the fact that in Texas and in Uvalde, for example, even before we get to Robb Elementary School and the student walkout of 1970, and we need to talk about that, even before that, you have 100 years of racial terror in Uvalde and in the surrounding region at the hands of the Texas Rangers and the KKK lynching Mexicans. That was the sport. And so just as in Mississippi and Alabama and the Deep South, there are very important righteous efforts we need to support to defend the historical memory of human rights crimes committed against African Americans in the name of racial purity and Jim Crow, the same was being done in Texas, and Uvalde is part of that story.
The idea, I believe, at the first set of funerals, you had the Border Patrol special band. Would it be mariachi that were playing for the funeral or for the people coming and going? So they're sort of right in there culturally. And, you know, there's so much cleansing of the truth. The presentation is amazing, but it's really hard to miss what happened if you just objectively keep an eye on, say, for instance, what happened that day, why the kids were sacrificed, the way in which law enforcement acted. And, you know, it all tells the same old story of extraordinary racism and abuse. It's just one variation on a theme. But it just so happens, Camilo, that in the context of this school, there is an amazing history that really does have a recorded, the battle's been recorded. So at least we know that this school, this place, this community has been in this for a long time.
And that's the thing we have to think about. You know, the solution now seems to be, and this has happened in, other mass shootings at schools, to demolish the site of the shooting, to eradicate the Robb Elementary School and reconstruct it either there or probably somewhere else. Well, one thing we have to think about is not erasing in that process the historical memory of other important things that Robb Elementary School stands for way before the shooting. We can't reduce the story of Robb Elementary School or the story of Uvalde and its community to the most recent horror. We have to put that horror in an overall historical framework. And when we do that, what we discover is that Robb Elementary School has to be remembered, again, not just for this mass shooting, but for the mass walkout of over 500 students in that school and in that community on April 14th, 1970, organized by a community-based struggle that was part of the broader history of the Chicano movement, locally, regionally, and nationally, and specifically of what was known as the Raza Unida Party, which was born just a few miles down the road from Uvalde in a little town called Crystal City or Cristal, the first town where the Raza Unida Party organized as a political movement that was able to win a majority on the school board. So that little town in Texas, the neighboring town to Uvalde, Cristal, became the beating heart of the National Chicano Movement. And it was, the sort of irradiating force of Cristal and of La Raza Unida that came to Uvalde in the form of the walkout movement. Now, why was there a walkout? Because it so happens that Robb Elementary School, and this is the other thing that has to be specifically remembered, in addition to the walkout, was one of those schools that were designated in Uvalde and in similar communities as a, quote, Mexican school. What that meant was it was a school segregated in the same way as the schools were in Brown versus Board of Education. Everybody knows about Brown versus Board of Education, although a lot of us have even forgotten that. But what we need to remember is there was also segregation of public schools and of public life. There was basically a Mexican version of Jim Crow throughout states like Texas that included the public schools. That includes California, by the way. That includes LA, a very important case in LA called Mendez versus Westminster, et cetera. So bottom line is states like Texas, states like California, border states in general, all of the states that were targets of colonial conquest, invasion, and resettlement as occupied communities, Uvalde is part of that story.
That was Camilo Perez Bustillo, Director of Research, Advocacy, and Leadership Development at the Hope Border Institute, based in the U.S.-Mexico border region in El Paso, Texas, and Dennis Bernstein, host of KPFA's Flashpoints.
Me miro en el espejo y veo en mi rostro el tiempo que he sufrido por tu adiós. Obligo a que te olvide el pensamiento, pues siempre estoy pensando en el ayer. Prefiero estar dormido que quisiera que tú vivieras, que tus ojitos jamás se hubieran cerrado nunca y estar mirándolos. Amor eterno e inolvidable, pero tarde o temprano yo voy a estar contigo para seguir amándolo.
Juan Gabriel, Amor Eterno. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Melissa Breimer, Director of Terrorism and Disaster Programs at the UCLA Duke National Center for Child Traumatic Stress, says American children regularly practice active shooter drills and consider the possibility of a crisis from a young age, making school shootings like the one in Uvalde very upsetting news for some. Many survivors of gun violence and their families experience trauma that must be addressed for emotional health and well-being. Here's longtime peace activist, intergenerational organizer, and author P.K. McCary of Pacifica Southwest Regional Station KPFT in Houston, Texas, in conversation with licensed and certified school counselor, educator, and storyteller Bronwyn Lucas about the mental and emotional well-being of our children.
So I've had the opportunity to work with children and youth and understand who they are and have a gift, I'd say, in being able to listen to them and listen to their heart. I've been blessed to have been a counselor who didn't just do the book counseling and the paperwork. I had the opportunity, even in the schools, to really be that person to listen and hear their voices.
The tragedy that has happened in Uvalde has many, many components. And one of the components is that this is mostly a Spanish-speaking community with a government that is mostly white. The individual who shot up the school was killed in the process. But there are so many hanging tabs that we've yet to grasp. Why are mothers being accosted by the police when they're trying to find out about what happened to their children? And yet, as we go a little bit further, and you and I both know that children, once they see something, they can't unsee it, but how they respond to it and what it does to their psyche later even in life, is something that we don't talk about in the school systems. We want to make these isolated events, and I'm just afraid that they're not isolated, that more events will come. So what do you think the practice should be for systems of education as we have to deal with this particular aspect? It will happen again. And when it happens again, will we be prepared to handle the fallout? Are we prepared now to handle the fallout?
I'll start with your last question, because that's easy. No, we're not prepared to handle the fallout. And I heard something really disturbing last night, that in certain school districts, we cannot connect the dots, but they connect dealing with mental health to critical race theory. That if there is a mental health problem, it has to do with, it's the same type of topic as critical race theory, and some school districts are saying that's something we're not going to deal with. The reason I bring that up, dealing with this for children is causing mental health issues. There's something called secondary trauma, where you were not in the actual incident, but you were traumatized by seeing it. You were traumatized by hearing it, and every time you hear it or see it, it is another trauma for you. So our children, our teachers, people in the school systems are experiencing secondary trauma just by knowing that the shootings happen. If we don't give it voice and talk about it, it doesn't make it go away. One of the things you find when you're talking with people in this profession, you know, we hear that our kids are numb to it, it doesn't bother them. No, they're numb to it, but it's not that it doesn't bother them. It is overwhelming, and they shut down. And when we don't give them voice to talk about what you see, what you heard, how you feel about this, they further shut down. And we've got to give them voice. We've got to allow the conversations to take place. That is where it begins. And what is the conversation? Ask them, what do you think about this? When you see it, how does it make you feel? And if you get the answer, I don't know, I just don't feel, well, what do you think? And then share what you feel. If they don't have the voice, you share. Well, what does it make? Share how you feel. It's like, well, when I see it, I'm overwhelmed. I just don't have words. That might lead them to say, me neither. That's why I just say, I don't know. So it's not an I don't know. So don't just take the quick and sweet answer. Begin to have a conversation, but know if they're ready. A child you're talking to may not be ready. For young children, they may know it and hear it, and it can really bring anxiety. Am I going to get shot? I can think of some clients I have who are scared to go outside. Some of my younger teenagers, my middle schoolers. See, just going to school, you could get killed, because they can process it and they can see it with fear and feel it with fear. So being able to talk to them. And then the parents who are scared and who don't know what to say because they agree with the child. I don't want you to go out. I'm scared. So giving voice to the feelings, I think, is very important. Having those conversations about the anxiety and the fear, letting your child know that you have some anxiety, not to overburden theirs, but that you understand their anxiety is important.
Bronwyn, we don't have all the answers, but there are some answers that we do have. And as a counselor, what do you suggest?
One of the choices we have is to individually know that we can make a difference where we are. Where there's all this hate being perpetrated, we need to stop being perpetrators of the hate ourselves, you know, not respond in hate. We need to talk to our children and listen, not just talk at them, have conversations with them. Listen to what they have to say. They may tell you a lot. You may find out how troubled they are and get them the help they need. And I always like to say for anyone, mental health is my mantra, meaning it is just a part of our health. We separate it and think that if I'm sad, if I'm depressed, if I'm schizophrenic, if I'm bipolar, it's something wrong with me. It's a weakness in who I am. It is not. It is just a part of your health issue that you need to address. So mental health is health. So take care of your health. Be a healthy person in every part. Understand that our children need voice. Find what you can do in your part of the world to make a difference. We need to be educated voters and advocates for change, as opposed to just saying, well, you know, they are going to do what they want to do. Be the advocate to make the change you want to see. So I see it as a both and. We have to deal with the mental health issue and the laws. We can't do one or the other. It has to be both. The laws that put it in place to make it easy to obtain this, and not just mental health when we think of the way we generally think about it, oh, you're mentally ill. No, just the mental health in terms of how you function, how you view people. Hate is driving our society, and that, for me, is a mental health issue. We allow that to be our driving force.
That was peace activist and author P.K. McCary and former Texas school counselor Bronwyn Lucas. If you need help or assistance, contact the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. They have resources available in both English and in Spanish. Their mission is to raise the standard of care and improve access to services for traumatized children, their families, and communities throughout the U.S. For more information, go online to nctsn.org. That's nctsn.org.
Sing with them. Come on. And let there be. There's restoration in the name of peace.
Let there be.
Our families are healed in the name, in the name. It's important that we each call her name, call her name. There's healing in the name of peace. Sing. There's joy in the name, in the name, in the name. Our children are safe in the name of peace. Our families are held in the name, all men get along in the name.
Sweet honey in the rock, let there be peace. You just heard a clip of the grieving community of Uvalde pleading with Texas Governor Greg Abbott to provide help and assistance for their families. In April of this year, Texas Governor Greg Abbott reportedly slashed $211 million from the Texas Health and Human Service, which oversees mental health programs. Texas ranked last out of all 50 states and the District of Columbia for overall access to mental health care, according to the 2021 report on the state of mental health in America. In downtown Houston, hundreds of people stood in the sweltering Texas heat for hours, protesting against gun violence and the NRA. Voices included the Texas American Federation of Teachers, the National Education Association, the Texas State Teachers Association, Texas Congressional Representatives Sheila Jackson Lee and Al Green, Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo, and other leaders and organizers held a rally to stand up against gun violence, responding to the tragedy in Uvalde and Buffalo, New York, as well as the NRA convention that was held in Houston, May 27th through the 29th.
Hello, Houston.
Hello.
Hello, Texas. Hello, America! And hello, the entire world who is watching us right now. I'm Liz Hanks, I'm the Texas chapter lead for Moms Demand Action. And there is worldwide media here today, and do you know why? Because we are an embarrassment around the entire world because we can't protect our children in their schools. We can't protect our children at our churches. We can't protect our community members in their grocery stores. We can't protect people driving down the street. And why is that? We know how to fix this problem. We have data that shows us how we fix it. Turn around and let them know how you feel about how they have not taken action on this issue. Shame on you. Shame, 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 shame.
I will not stop lifting my voice until every one of our babies can go to school and be safe. I will not stop lifting my voice until every one of our children in every one of their communities is safe from gun violence. The 3 million members of the NEA will not stop lifting their voice until every single one of our children has what they need and deserve, and they can live and thrive and be brilliant.
Dede Bridgewater's Children Are the Spirit of the World. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The Texas Senate Democratic Caucus urged Governor Greg Abbott to call an emergency special legislative session to consider a number of gun restrictions and safety measures, including raising the minimum age to purchase a firearm from 18 to 21, according to the Texas Tribune. The caucus is also calling for universal background checks for all firearm sales, red flag laws that allow a judge to temporarily remove firearms from people who are considered an imminent threat to themselves or others, a cooling off period for the purchase of a firearm, and regulations on high capacity magazines for citizens. Senate Democrats have criticized Governor Abbott for blaming a broken mental health care system that he and others have underfunded. Texas teachers have faced one attack after another from the COVID pandemic and now the massacre in Uvalde. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with three teachers, Jacqueline Martinez, Michael Hulb, and Amy Lopez, about the issues they're facing.
Hey, my name is Jacqueline Martinez. I just finished my 12th year as a bilingual elementary school teacher here in Texas. Basically, due to the pandemic, I had temporarily resigned from teaching. And even though there were issues pre-pandemic, they were just significantly exacerbated because of the pandemic. And it was then that I decided to take my advocacy journey to the next level on social media. And it's the message, which was, you know, that we need to normalize advocacy among teachers. We need to put an end to toxic leadership that thrives throughout our profession. It resonated with so many teachers. Here we are. 2 years later, and really nothing has changed. There is still that really deeply embedded fear among teachers that if they were to speak out and use their voice and advocate, that there would be retaliation. And so that is something that I am very much against. I really have this goal of empowering teachers to use their voice and advocate and normalize it, so that it's not seen as something that's, you know, bold or daring, but just something that's normal, something that teachers do regardless.
My name is Michael Hull. I'm a certified history teacher from Texas. I'm the founder of the national protest group Teachers Against Dying. Now we're Teachers Against Dying 2.0 because we're still dying from the same superstructures that led to the mass death in the pandemic. And we're against essentially normalizing these things. We're against normalizing death. You can't just pass it off as thoughts and prayers. Got to form a resistance against this, call it for what it is, in the face of this onslaught, this assault against the working class, against the institution of education. We've got to call it out for what it is. It's insidious, it's rapacious, and even if I'm in the minority screaming, I will do it till the day I die.
What is it like being a teacher in Texas with a governor, Abbott, and a state apparatus who basically are saying, you're just going to go to the classes and you have to take it?
It's crazy. It's like you're in this world where everybody is against you. And it's the best way I could describe it is I understand now how Hitler came to power. I understand how Hitler came to power. When I live in Texas, the people are so propagandized. There's just so much fear. And if you just look at our political discourse, if you come down here, you'll see on the television every political season, it's always the transgender people. They're coming. They're coming for your kids. They're the teachers. They're teaching you critical race theory. They're trying to take away what's, you know, everything about America that's the, you know, the what made us great, which I guess they were referring to fear and hate. It was part of a bigger superstructure. So people being herded back to their deaths during the pandemic, it wasn't some fly-by-night thing. It was part of the superstructure, which is we have a country that's controlled by lobbyists and capital, and people were being herded back to their deaths.
That's right.
For the Dow Jones. So when we look at the gun violence, it's a manifestation of the same thing. It's, you know, people like Ted Cruz know better. He went to the Ivy League. He knows better than, you know, to fix the doors. That's not a solution. You don't audit it with people coming in and pretending to be active shooters. That's not the solution. They know better. They're doing it for their NRA buddies, for the lobby. And the NRA, it masquerades as a civil rights group, but it's really a lobbyist firm for the ammunition and arms manufacturers. So all of these things, you know, you can connect it to the bigger superstructure. Like I always say, if you show me a government failure, I could probably show you a good business model. Going back to the Wild West, and I noticed in the Ohio bill that they just passed to arm teachers, it was only 24 hours of training. And of course, there's no pay raise included in this additional responsibility that you're supposed to do, which is being a security guard on top of being a healthcare professional and diagnosing COVID symptoms. I guess we forgot about all that, but we had to do that. Remember, we had to have sanitation teams, and we were sanitation workers. And no corresponding raise. And that's why people are quitting. That's why we're hemorrhaging talent, because it's come to a head. It's come to an impasse. The chickens have come home to roost.
You know, it's really interesting. One of the first things that teachers were quick to point out when people were suggesting arm the teachers is that, wait a minute, you don't trust us to choose the books that students read. You call us indoctrinators, you call us groomers. You don't trust us to do any of that, to teach. You don't trust us to teach, but you're totally willing to put a gun in our hands to protect the students. It's really awful to think that we're demonized because we don't want that responsibility. Nobody went into teaching to shoot a gun. We would have joined the armed forces. We would have become a police officer, a cop. That's not the profession that we chose. We chose to teach. And as many people have expressed, we're basically like sitting ducks right now in Texas. And now that Abbott has suggested to do a simulation of an active shooter going it, like, the man clearly does not understand mental health. He doesn't understand triggers. He doesn't understand all the things that could go wrong with that idea. And it's just really unfortunate that teachers will always get, you know, the short end of the stick. They want to blame this on mental health now. Okay. But it wasn't too long ago, prior to the Uvalde shooting, that he had cut funding for mental health. Teachers really struggled with stress and mental health prior to the pandemic. And of course, it just got worse, right? This is not to stigmatize mental health in any way, but there are just so many teachers that I've worked with that I would not want them having access to a gun.
Right.
And there's just so many different ways that it could go wrong. An African-American teacher could be mistaken for the shooter when police arrive. A teacher might be in such a state of stress that they shoot a student. probably a student of color. There's just so many things that could go wrong. And like I said earlier, they don't trust us with curriculum and we're groomers, but let's put a gun in.
And in Texas, the government and other states, we've got to militarize. We've got to have more guns, more guards. Do you think having more police in the schools is going to protect you?
Look how well that worked for Uvalde. And they're still standing by that. 19 standing around in the hallway. And many of them went and got their own kids out. And who knows where their kids were in the building compared to where, you know, the shooter was. But if they would have handled the situation, they could have kept him from going on to those other parts.
And there were so many police. I understand there were 130 police around that school. Border police, state police, local police.
Tasing parents, handcuffing parents.
Yeah, they were crowd control. That's what they were. They were crowd control. They showed up. They did nothing. And that now they want us to do their job and jump in front of a bullet. And this whole good guy with a gun idea, that's not the answer. More guns is not the answer. It has to be direct democracy. So what the people in the unions will always say is you can't do it in Texas. You can't do a strike. You can't do this. You can't. So my thought is, since I'm paying my dues to Miss Weingarten's $500,000 salary, why can't she and Pringle and the union bureaucrats that are the national leadership, why can't they coordinate a national strategy? There are some places you could call a strike, right? There are some places you could do this and get concessions on a national level. So if all the states that where it could be done, we would do it and we would shut the states down and say, we at least want an assault weapons ban, or at least give us a red flag law that applies across the country. Give us a waiting period. Give us screenings. Give us something.
Those were the voices of Texas teachers, Michael Hull, Amy Lopez, and Jacqueline Martinez, and producer Steve Zelter. California Congressman Eric Swalwell asked his Republican colleagues, "Who are you here for?" last Thursday. A post on his Twitter page stated he was at the House Judiciary meeting in support of a package of bills to reduce the persistent gun violence that has torn apart families and communities.
Who are you here for, the kids or the killers? My Republican colleagues are here for carnival games. They say it's about mental health. Okay, we try and fund mental health, they vote against it. They say it's about schools. We try and fund the schools, fund the teachers, they vote against it. They say it's about policing. $300 million in the American Rescue Plan for community policing. They all voted against it. And they don't want to listen to the police. If they listened to the police, they'd listen to the major cities' chiefs who have called for background checks, red flag laws, banning bump stocks, and banning high-capacity magazines. My favorite, it's about the family. We need to address the family issues in America. But we don't want to help feed a family. We're going to make it harder for kids to live on food stamps. We don't want to help a family learn. We're going to go after teachers in America. We don't want to help kids go to college. We don't want to give them jobs. We're going to vote against the infrastructure and jobs bill. And then they say that laws don't work. But they have no problem crafting laws to take away a woman's right to make her own healthcare decision. That law must work. They have no problem going after laws to ban drugs. There's plenty of laws on the books to ban drugs. But no, it's all about the person. Laws don't work when you have evil in our country. That's what they tell us. And then they tell us that we're in a country where you have violent video games, mental health problems, schools that can't be secured, and too many gun-free zones. And their solution to that is to put more of the most dangerous weapons into that mix. That's insane. They're also out of touch with the overwhelming majority of gun owners in America. An organization called 97% just put out a poll that said among gun owners, and they only polled gun owners, 86% support background checks, 76% support safe storage, 67% support red flag laws. Those are gun owners. So who are you here for? Our kids or the killers?
Last Poets, This Is Madness.
tell me.
I don't work in this town.
Sure. I know, it's fine. I don't work in this town. But the ones that work here.
We are all waiting for this, sir. But there's no reason to live in the past. There's nothing we can do.
A grieving grandparent, mourning and crying out in Uvalde, asking why, trying to make sense of it all.
Save me from this prison. Lord, help me get away. 'Cause only you can save me now from this misery. Getting weary. How far is heaven? And I know that I need to change my ways of living. How far is heaven? Lord, can you tell me?
Los Lonely Boys, Heaven. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. For the political and historical context behind the recent wave of mass shootings in the U.S., we'll now hear from historian and author Dr. Gerald Horn, Morris Professor of History at the University of Houston.
I guess we all witnessed the hideous shooting in Uvalde, Texas. There was also a shooting, an ideologically motivated shooting in Buffalo by a white supremacist, someone who left a manifesto who was inspired by the Christchurch shooting in New Zealand by another neo-Nazi and Islamophobe, Brandon Tarrant, who actually had made contacts in Ukraine. So there are a lot of elements there. But the way that the Uvalde shooting is framed is sort of as this senseless act of violence, and different political factions in the U.S. are pointing the finger at their political adversaries to blame them. What was your initial reaction, Dr. Horn? And how do you see this shooting in the context of your book on Texas and the very violent history of this state?
Well, first of all, let me say, like many others, not only in Texas, but nationally and perhaps globally, it was shocking and horrific, but predictable. Predictable because, as we all know, there are more weapons in this country than there are human beings. We also know that there is a political economy of this kind of violence, insofar as there is a major arms industry in this country. And as one recent author put it, there is a river of weapons flowing southward from the United States into Mexico, often going into the hands of drug cartels, and not only to Mexico, but throughout the hemisphere, particularly into Haiti. We also are aware of the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which has received many interpretations over the decades, but the latest interpretation put forward by the right wing has been to allow for the further proliferation of weapons in the U.S. Supreme Court. Has a decision on tap within a few days, perhaps a few weeks, that will probably unleash further weapons into the hands of the right wing. Now, with regard to the Second Amendment, this raises a very important question of history. History not only relevant to the United States, but relevant to Texas. You cannot begin to understand the Second Amendment without understanding settler colonialism, a descriptor that sadly and unfortunately is largely absent from the vocabularies of many of our friends on the left, that, as is evident, describes a system whereby hundreds of years ago, European invaders came to North America and by dint of weapons were able to seize the land from the Native Americans and as well were able to keep the enslaved Africans in line that they had shackled and manacled on the west coast of Africa in particular, and dragged, kicking and screaming across the Atlantic to engage in free labor. In other words, the Second Amendment was designed to effectuate settler colonialism, which reaches a kind of efflorescence with the proclamation of the United States in the late 18th century and its vaunted Bill of Rights and its vaunted Constitution. And keep in mind that the Second Amendment did not apply to the enslaved population, nor did it apply to the indigenous population. Those in your audience who are familiar with the cinematic genre known as Westerns know that a stock villain in many Westerns was a settler who sold weapons to indigenous populations. And going forward, I'm afraid to say that that particular construct is still in evidence. Recall what happened in 1967 when the Black Panther Party invaded, to use the term the press used, the Capitol in Sacramento with arms in hand. Even right wingers, even some leaders of the National Rifle Association did a 180 degree reversal and came out in favor of gun control, illustrating the point that the Second Amendment was not necessarily designed for all of us. Or look at the killing of Philando Castile in Minnesota a few years ago. Supposedly he was reaching for a weapon. This is a young Black man. The image is captured on video, I'm afraid to say. The National Rifle Association did not rally to the defense of this man who had a Second Amendment right but was slain by a police officer in a bruising confrontation. Likewise, I think we would be remiss if we failed to connect the domestic to the global. That is to say that we're all familiar with the ravenous U.S. foreign policy that is engaged in murderous escapades in Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, and sites too numerous to mention. And the fact is that that illustrates the point that political disputes should be settled through the barrel of a gun. It also leads to a certain kind of cheapening of life that is returned with velocity to these shores, not to mention the fact that inevitably, I think it's coarsened the psyche of too many in this country, leading predictably to what happened in Uvalde and in Buffalo. Speaking of the latter, of course, we should mention the so-called white replacement theory that drove this terrorist in Western New York, the idea that somehow there is a conspiracy to replace the Euro-American population with people of color. Supposedly, there is a Jewish cabal that is pulling the strings for all of this. It helped to drive the murderous adventure in New Zealand a few years ago. We know about its roots in France. But it's also, as you know, been picked up by Fox News, by Tucker Carlson.
Ends of it all. Los Lonely Boys, Heaven. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. For the political and historical context behind the recent wave of mass shootings in the U.S., we'll now hear from historian and author Dr. Gerald Horn, Morris Professor of History at the University of Houston. Dr. Gerald Horn speaking to the Gray Zone's Max Blumenthal. Dr. Horn currently holds the John J. and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He is the author of many books, including his most recent work, The Counter-Revolution of 1836, Texas Slavery and Jim Crow, and the Roots of American Fascism. Philadelphia's own Kenny Gamble, media strategist Diana Williams, and radio DJ Ed Wright created Black Music Month in 1979 to promote and preserve Black music. On June 7, 1979, President Jimmy Carter held the first ever Black Music Month celebration on the White House lawn. Here's Grammy Award-winning pianist, record producer, songwriter, and musical arranger with a career that bridges several different musical and art genres, and native of Houston, Texas, Robert Glasper. Ethiopian rainy season that has just begun will mark the third filling of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, a project that has united Ethiopians throughout its construction. COVID Race and Democracy's Anne Garrison reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
85% of the waters that become the Nile River originate in Ethiopia, in Lake Tana, and the river that most of the world call the Blue Nile. However, Ethiopians don't call it that. It's the Abay River to them, and it's muddy, heavy with sediment. It becomes the Blue Nile only after crossing into Sudan, where it joins the White Nile to become the Nile before crossing into Egypt. In Sudan, the water level is so high during flood times that the river changes color to almost black, and in the local Sudanese language, the word for black is also used for blue. Egypt has claimed to own every last drop of Ethiopia's Abay River because it flows into what they call the Nile, and a British colonial treaty deeded all waters flowing into the Nile to them. On these flimsy grounds, Egypt bitterly opposed construction of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam on Ethiopia's Abay River just before it flows into Sudan and becomes the Blue Nile. Tension between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia over the dam continues, but the dam is built. It began generating electricity in February this year, and the third filling is now underway. Ethiopians and the Ethiopian diaspora take great pride in having financed the dam's construction by purchasing bonds. Even as Ethiopians struggle with the enormous damage done during the TPLF's 27 years of U.S.-backed divide and rule ethnic politics, the dam unites across ethnic lines. An Egyptian engineer quoted in Al Monitor described this strength from Egypt's still bitter viewpoint when he said, "Ethiopia is exploiting the GERD project politically at the domestic level, claiming it is a national project unifying all Ethiopian ethnic groups." Ethiopian businessman and philanthropist Ramsey Shah says that's more than a claim.
Exactly. It is more than a claim. And it's the heart of the whole Ethiopian people, way past the ethnic divisions and the political polarity. Anybody who is an Ethiopian bought the bonds to be part of this history. It's their heart and their soul building the dam. It's a way out of poverty. And everything is financed through Ethiopians, even between the age lines, even domestic workers who work in Arab countries have contributed to that. So it's basically, it is a beacon, you know, for the African nation, a way to prosperity.
In Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button and follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, what must we do to save our elders, our children, and our beloved communities? We must do something. Audre Lorde once said, "Your silence will not protect you."